Okay, everyone. So, welcome back again. We are going to continue, surprise, surprise, carry on, as I say. So, excellent. Thank you, Coffee Cup. So, just to remind you what we are doing, we are looking at the life of the Buddha to be. Yeah, we're looking at the Buddha, what motivated the Buddha to practice the path. We have looking at a whole sutta on the motivations of the Buddha to be, the ideas of dying and death and sickness and all of those kind of things. And we're going to continue to look at the motivations of the Buddha that made him go forth and to decide to become a monk. So far, the things we have looked at are the things that are very personal. Yeah, dying, old age, illness, corruption have to do with your person and the things immediately around you, like your family and these kind of things. And now we're going to look at larger issues, like the world in general. This is a different reason for going forth. These are kind of two, they are basically very closely related to each other, obviously. But there are the problems of our personal life, and then there are the problems of the world in general, the different ways of thinking about the world and why it is worthwhile practicing the spiritual path. And this particular sutta that I'm going to look at now is known as the Atta Danda Sutta. And it is a sutta that is not talked about very much. I have talked about it a few times recently, and some of you may have heard me talk about this before. It is found in the Sutta Nipata, which is one of the books of the Kudaka Nikaya. Do you all know the Buddhist scriptures really well, or do you know them not so well? Not so well. Okay, so the Buddhist scriptures are five collections, five collections of scriptures. You have the long discourses of the Buddha, you have the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, the connected discourses of the Buddha, and then the numerical discourses of the Buddha. These are the four main collections of Buddhist scriptures. And if you ever want to read the word of the Buddha, that's where I recommend you go. Read those four collections. And most of the suttas that I've chosen are taken from those collections. But there's another collection called the Kudaka Nikaya, which means the small collection. The small collection is the biggest collection. It's weird because the small collection is like an extra. Yeah, so that's where you put in all the extra books. And there was always more extra, more extra, more extra, more extra, more extra. And eventually it became this enormous collection. This is like the small collection is as big as all the other collections together, basically. Yeah. And in that small collection, there are some books that are very old. They have the same feeling as the early suttas. They are part of what we might call the early Buddhist texts. Yeah, they are really what you would call the word of the Buddha. And then there are large parts that have nothing to do with the word of the Buddha that are later additions to the Kudaka Nikaya. Now, this particular collection that we're looking at now is known as the Ataka Vagga, the chapter of eights. And this is one of the most ancient parts of the Kudaka Nikaya. It's part of one book called the Sutta Nipata, which is one of 18 books of the Kudaka Nikaya. And within the Sutta Nipata is divided into five chapters. One of those chapters called the Attakavagga. And this is what we're looking at now. And this is the we know this is ancient because these suttas are also found in Chinese translation and they are recorded elsewhere. And this is how we can know that these are ancient verses. So this is one of those suttas, Attakavagga, chapter of eight. Usually they have eight verses in each sutta. This sutta has many more than eight, so I don't know why it is there, but it is still there. So the Atta Danda Sutta of the Attakavagga, of the Sutta Nipata, of the Kudaka Nikaya, of the Sutta Pitaka. If you can't follow what I'm saying, don't worry. So, the name Atta Danda, taking up arms, Danda means like a stick or punishment or a weapon. Yeah, that's why it translates as arms. It could also translate as punishment, or you can translate as a weapon if you like. Or stick is actually the literal meaning of the word danda. Do you have such a word in Malay language? Danda, same, yeah? Punishment. Oh, there you are. See, yeah, this is yeah, because Malay has a lot of Sanskrit words in it, you know. So there you are, danda, exactly. Yeah. So, how do you say it in Malay? Danda, danda. Okay, there you are. Good. That's really cool, isn't it? And it shows you how powerful Buddhism was in this area a long time ago. It was very powerful in this part of the world before Islam came to Malaysia. Buddhism was the main religion here, and so it was very strong. The famous dynasties they had around this area, and also in Indonesia, all of Indonesia, this whole part of the world. So that danda and atta means something like taking up. So the people who take up punishment, stick, weapons, these kind of things. Remember, we're now looking at how the Buddha to be, how he reflected on the world, how he thought about the world, trying to understand the world in the right way. And here he's seeing how people and beings, how they take up problems, causing problems for everyone. So this is how this sutta goes. And this is the Bhantisujato's translation that we have here. It says, peril stems from those who take up arms. Just look at people in conflict. I shall extol how I came to be stirred with a sense of urgency. This is the first of a large number of verses in this particular sutta. I'm going to look mostly on the first few verses, because they are about view, right view, and the rest of the sutta is really about the practice and then the result of the practice. The most interesting part is the beginning here. So peril stems from those who take up arms, or take up punishment, or take up sticks, or whatever. Peril, the Pali word is bhaya, and it actually literally means something like fear. Fear is born from those who take up sticks. So when people in the world want to punish you, they take up arms, they do all these kind of things, it leads to fear in the world. It leads to a problem. Is it possible to have a world where no one picks up sticks, where no one has punishment, there is no arms? Is that really possible? And if that is impossible, there will always be fear. There will always be peril. This problem will always exist in the world. If we can understand the world in the right way, maybe a world without fear, without peril, without these kind of terrible things, maybe that actually is impossible. And of course, we know it is impossible. Fear is an inescapable part of the human realm. Everyone will have fear sometimes. Everyone will feel anxious sometimes. Anxiety and fear are just two sides of the same coin. And I will, in a second, I will explain a little bit more about why that is the case. So just look at people in conflict. The conflict here are people who are arguing with each other, always quarreling with each other. When people quarrel and argue, they often end up with punishment, and they end up with weapons and sticks, and they do bad things to each other because of all this conflict that we have. Now, one of the important things to understand about humanity in any kind of world, conflict is unavoidable. Why is conflict unavoidable? Well, for many reasons, but one of the reasons is simply that each one of us, we see the world slightly differently. We have slightly different background, we have slightly different conditioning, different parents, different past lives, and all of these kind of things mean that we relate to the world in different ways, and so we see the world differently. And this is why we have different kinds of friends. This is why we have different people we like and different people we don't like. This is why we vote for different parties, because we see things in a different way. And we think that our way is right and the other person are wrong. Isn't that true? Of course we think we are right. How can you not think you're right? It's crazy. Of course you have to think you're right. So that's, otherwise you wouldn't do what you're doing if you didn't think you were right. So we have to think we are right. But the other person also thinks they're right, and that's the problem. And when we all think we are right, but we have different viewpoints, that is where conflict arises. And that means that conflict is inherent to the human realm. Because we have different viewpoints, different perceptions, we are never going to agree 100%. And so conflict is going to arise. And very often these viewpoints that we have, the perceptions that we have about the world, they relate to our sense of self. This is me. I have this view. This is my view. And because related to myself, it is very important to us. And if someone challenges it, we're not going to be able to let go easily. Because these views are an inherent aspect of what we take ourselves to be. If you ask a Christian, you say, tell them there is no God, they're not going to like that. Right? They're not going to say, oh yeah, you're probably right about that. No way they're going to say that, because that is a very important part of their identity. Yeah, and if someone says to a Buddhist that the Buddha is stupid, you're not going to like it probably. Actually, I probably just should shrug our shoulders, okay, think whatever you want. You know, I don't care what you think. But the reality that some of these views are very important to us, are very dear to our heart, because they come from the sense of self. Especially important philosophical views like the idea of eternalism, or that you're going to be annihilated when you pass away. Very closely related to our sense of being. And so conflict is inevitable in the world, right? And when there is conflict, because it is inevitable in the world, it also means that the taking up of arms, the taking up of sticks, the taking up punishment, that too is inevitable, because it is an extension of the idea of conflict. Which means there's always going to be fear in the world. You're always going to be fearful. It's impossible to get away from fear. Yeah, because of conflict around us, watching TV, seeing the wars in the world, seeing the Ukrainians being invaded, seeing China saber-rattling with the US. Yeah, maybe the Third World War is around the corner. What do you think? Yeah. Yes, some people say yes, some people say no. Okay, so you're already disagreeing. Yeah, so that's more conflict right there. It's possible, right? We just don't know what's going to happen. Maybe not, hopefully not, but we just don't know. And this is kind of, it leads to a degree of anxiety. We don't want the Third World War. Imagine having the Third World War. It's going to be incredibly destructive and very bad for everyone in this world. I don't know if you can live as a monk or a nun if there's a Third World War. Maybe that's going to be really hard. Yeah. What's going to happen if you do that? Because people are not going to have the time to look after monastics, maybe. Maybe you're going to get drafted to the army. Well, I'm too old to get drafted to the army, so I can relax. But all of these kind of things happen. And that is kind of very unpleasant, the idea that the world, conflict, fear, anxiety, all of these things are inherent in the world. You can't get away from it. It's very unpleasant. We always try to create better societies. We try to have more peace in the world. And of course, you can succeed to some extent. There are some countries are more peaceful than others. Some people are better governed than others. So there is some degree of success in these things. But it's never going to be complete. There's always going to be a residue, anxiety, fear, violence, all of these kind of things. And that is very problematic. And this is, of course, why the spiritual path is so important. Because the spiritual path then is about withdrawing from that world. That world I'm talking about is the five sense world, the world outside of us. The world outside is always the five sense world. And when you go inside, within, and you practice a spiritual path, you're practicing inner qualities instead. That is why the spiritual path is withdrawing from that five sense world, withdrawing from that conflict, and building up resilience, and building up strong qualities inside instead. And as we do that, we have a refuge from the world outside. The Buddha says in the suttas that satipatthana practice, which basically is mindfulness of breathing, that is the refuge from the world. You withdraw from all of that. This is why the spiritual path is so powerful. This is why this whole change in view, understanding what the world really is about, is a powerful force to encourage us to practice the spiritual path. This is the only way. And of course, if you do practice the spiritual path, you become a more harmonious person, and you don't take part in that conflict in the same way. You become a source for peace in the world. You become a blessing for the world, not just for yourself, but also for everyone else. That's kind of nice, isn't it? To be a blessing for both yourself and for everyone. That's something very beautiful about that. And certainly if I think about my own life, I would rather be a blessing than a curse. I don't know about you, but it's not nice to be a curse, right? So it's kind of, being a blessing is kind of nice. Being a curse is kind of unpleasant. So once you see this, once you understand the world in this way, then he says, I shall extol how I became stirred with a sense of urgency. The urgency arises. Wow, that's what the world is like. I've got to get out of this. I don't want to be part of this. I have the opportunity now. If I don't do it now, when is the opportunity going to come again? The urgency arises from right view. The more right view you have, the more inclined you are going to be to the spiritual path, and you will feel that sense of urgency. Yeah, so understanding this is very important. And you don't have to read the sutta to know this is true. All you have to do is turn on the TV or read the newspaper, and you can see it's all happening in the world right now. You know, it's in, just read a news article and you're enough to become anxious already. So it's all there in our face, in a sense. So what you have to do, one of the very important things about all these teachings, you have to connect the suttas to the real world outside. See the connection, because this is about the real world. So don't allow one to be in the realm of theory and the other to be in the realm of practical things. You need to merge those two realms. And when they merge, that's when it becomes very interesting. Let's go on to the next verse. I saw this population flounder like a fish in a little puddle. Seeing them fight each other, fear came upon me. This is the Buddha to be. Fear came upon me, right? Like I was saying before, the Buddha is a human being. He has the same kind of emotions that we have. He has fear. Elsewhere we have seen that he has attachments. We saw that in the previous sutta, being attached to all of these things. He has a kind of a love for the sensual pleasures of the world like everyone else. And fear, and elsewhere we have seen greed and ill will. So you can see all of this humanizes the Buddha. He is just like us prior to his awakening. After his awakening is a bit different, but prior to his awakening he's just like us. Again, very powerful. So he saw, but the difference between the Buddha and us is the Buddha has a very acute understanding of the world. He looks at the world and he takes in what is really happening in the world in a very powerful way. So he saw the population flounder. Flounder here is like almost like a thrashing about, being restless, trying to move, not really being able to get out of things. Like a fish in a puddle. If you have a fish in a puddle, the fish will thrash about trying to get out, but there's nowhere to go. It's in a little puddle, right? There's nothing that the fish can do. And so the fish is trapped in that puddle. In the same way, we, the population of the world, all of us, we are trapped in this five-sense existence. And we are thrashing about in this five-sense existence, trying to find a solution, traveling all over the world, making treatises with a neighboring country, trying to find peace, trying to sort it out, thrashing around, being ever restless, driven by craving. And what do we get? We don't really get anywhere. There is no solution. There is a temporary solution. There is a partial movement towards something positive, but there's no permanent solution in this realm of ours. And this is kind of really important. You know, humanity, we are very good at trying to create utopias. You have the communist utopia, you see what happened in Cambodia, where they tried to kind of create a utopian communist country, and they ended up killing millions of people. You can see the madness of utopias. So in Buddhism, we reject all utopias. This is kind of interesting about Buddhism. Utopias are impossible because according to Buddhism, everything is always impermanent. Everything is always changing. Everything is kind of driven by these deeper underlying problems in the human mind of greed, hatred, and delusion. And because these things are the most powerful forces in the world, these are the things that we always want more. Because we always want more, because we're never satisfied. There is no end point. And because there is no end point, an utopia is impossible. The utopia will be used in the service of greed. Look at some of the countries in the world where they had tried communist regimes, like Russia, for example. They were still a wealthy elite. The wealthy elite used the system to enrich themselves. And this is always going to be the case. So utopia is impossible, whether it is a communist, socialist, capitalist, whatever kind of utopia. There is no final stage. There is no end point. So we are thrashing about. We have this five-sense realm, trying to sort things out, trying ever restless, always agitated, never finding a solution, thrashing about in this realm. And then, of course, part of that thrashing about is that we end up fighting each other. And then, when the Buddha sees this fighting, then fear comes, the Buddha-to-be, fear comes upon him. There's this nice simile that I always talk about in these particular retreats I do, and this is the simile that is found in the Potalia Sutta, and the simile of the piece of meat, the Mangsapesi upama. And this is the simile of a bird that gets hold of a piece of meat. Yeah, for a bird, a piece of meat is very valuable. Usually a bird has to eat worms. Yeah, worms and grubs, piece of meat. Yay! So happy. And a piece of meat here is basically a metaphor for the sensual pleasures of the world. Yeah? Finally, I got a nice partner. Finally, got a nice house. Finally, have a nice car. Yeah? Wow, I feel so lucky. Yeah, got it. But then the bird flies off with a piece of meat. But because a piece of meat is so valuable in for a bird, other birds come after it. And they try to get hold of that piece of meat. And because these other birds are larger maybe than the previous bird and stronger than the previous bird, they try to rip that piece of meat out of the beak or out of the claws of that bird. And when they try to rip that piece of meat out, the other bird, either it has to let go of the piece of meat, or it may die in the fight that comes from that. So this is kind of the world around us. The world is that we are all looking for the same sensual pleasures in the world. The world outside is limited. And because the world outside is limited and we all desire the same things. Have you noticed how everyone wants the same partner? Yeah, if one person is attractive, many people think they're attractive. Okay, everyone wants that person. If we are smart and we divide it evenly, there will be plenty for everyone. But no, we're not like that. We want the same thing, right? Okay, you have a really nice car. Other people become envious. I want the same kind of car, right? Or you have a nice house or whatever. Or we go to work. Everyone is trying to kind of get a promotion and they have office politics. Or we are trying to get, you know, if you have children, you're fighting over the toys or whatever it is. And when your parents eventually die, you fight over the inheritance. Do people fight over the inheritance here in Malaysia as well? And the richer you are, the more they fight, right? It's crazy, isn't it? It's completely crazy. And this is the problem with the world, because these things are outside of us. Because we want the same things in the world. We're all searching for the same thing. And the resources are limited. The resources are limited in the world. The economy is only so large. The pie, the cake is only so large. You can only have one small, you know, segment of that pie. And if someone else takes more, you get less. And you say, don't take my part. And because we are greedy, it's never going to work out. This is why conflict is inherent in the society. And this is kind of a very fascinating thing for me, because once you understand that conflict, violence and all of these things is inherent in the five sense realm, there's no way of getting out of it. It makes the five sense realm much less interesting. Yeah. As soon as you have something, someone else is going to want it. As soon as you have a nice partner, someone else is going to want that nice partner. And this is the way it goes. And you will always be fearful of losing your partner, because they may find someone else as well. Anxiety, violence, fear, all of these things revolving around each other. So you start to feel a little bit, okay, maybe that world is not so interesting. Maybe there's somewhere else I can go, where I can find a freedom from those problems. And of course, the answer is the inner world, once again, in your inner world, because you don't share it with other people, because it's your private world, there is no conflict anymore. This is the power of these spiritual teachings. You go to a place where there is no conflict, a place where you can actually build up good qualities, which is a real refuge from the world outside. And that refuge is so powerful and so wonderful precisely for that reason. So this is the problem of the world. And then even for the Buddha to be, fear came upon him. It's kind of fascinating. So let's do a few minutes of meditation practice, and then we'll do some Q&A. Okay, everyone. So let us take some questions. Lai, are you here? Are you here, Lai? He's not here. Okay. He mentioned before that it was possible to turn on this aircon over here. Does anyone know how to do that? Yeah, might be a nice idea. Sorry. Okay, any questions, comments, ideas?
Being new to sutta studies or reading or let's call it studies, how should we go about there's five nikayas, and which one should we go for? Should we start with Majjhima and Dika?
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
the first question. Or should we look like, should we read cover to cover? And if that is, we should go Nikaya by Nikaya, then how should we do it? Should we read one sutta, then contemplate, reflect, rather than like a story, you know, endlessly reading?
Yeah.
Or secondly, should we look at it from a thematic perspective? Should we look at just rebirth, and then we look up every sutta that is relating to rebirth, and then contemplate on that?
Yeah, all right. So it doesn't really matter so much how you do it. What matters is that you enjoy it. That's the most important thing here. Yeah? Everything in Buddhism should be about enjoying. Yeah? And so when you read the suttas and you find that you don't enjoy a sutta, just skip it. Don't like the next one? Skip it. Don't like the next one? Skip it. Don't like the next one? Skip it. If you like one sutta in the whole collection, that's enough. Yeah. So the point is that in Buddhism, if we force ourselves to do these kind of things, sometimes we have to put a little bit of effort into it, and you have to kind of put a bit of energy into it. But generally speaking, the idea of forcing yourself, it takes away the joy of the spiritual path. It should be joyful, it should be happy. So sometimes you need to read things that are a little bit challenging, and it may not be joyful. Okay, sometimes you read that. But generally speaking, it should be something you enjoy. So that means that you read, if you don't enjoy it, go to something else. If it is neutral, you don't enjoy it on it, then it's up to you whether you want to carry on or not. Then you can carry on. Well, a good place to start is a book called In the Buddha's Words. In the Buddha's Words. In the Buddha's Words. And this is a compilation of suttas by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Bhikkhu Bodhi is number one translator of suttas into English. Bhikkhu Bodhi. And this is a very nice, and this is exactly arranged, as you're saying, thematically. So this is thematically arranged, and then it has nice introductions, it has nice notes at the end to explain what is going on, so it makes it easier for you to get access to it. That's a good place to start. Another thing I would encourage you to do is to read suttas that also are inspiring suttas. Some suttas are more like, they can be inspiring, but they're more like, the Buddha kind of gives a teaching, and sometimes it can be not necessarily very inspiring. The Buddha's like, do this, don't do that. But there are verses, for example. The verses can be very inspiring. Yeah? And one famous book of verse is the Dhammapada. Dhammapada is very, very nice to read. Another interesting book of verse that might be interesting, especially for women, is the Therigata. Therigata are the verses of the elder nuns. The elder Arahant Bhikkhunis, the fully enlightened nuns. Therigata. T-H-E-R-I. T-H-E-R-I. G-A-T-H-A. Therigata. So these are actually very inspiring, yeah? And because sometimes it's nice, if you're a woman, it's nice to get some from some elder nuns, yeah? I can understand that, why that is the case. So these are nice and inspiring verses. Another thing I would recommend you to do, if you are interested in the sutta, it can be difficult to draw all the meaning out of the suttas. Yeah, this is what I see as my job, is to draw the meaning out of the suttas. And it probably would be difficult for most of you to draw as much meaning out of these things as I am doing, because I'm very used to these suttas and know the meaning quite deeply. So for that reason, it can be good to listen to people online. Yeah, go to YouTube, find someone who explains the suttas. This can also be a very useful tool. And there are lots of monks and monks of people who do that. I am one of the people who do that. You can go to our website in Perth, bswa.org, and you will find lots of explanations of many suttas. bswa.org here. bswa.org. And yeah, Buddhist Society Western Australia, bswa.org. And you will find that there are many other monastics as well, and lay people as well. There is actually a Malaysian man called Pia Tan. You know Pia Tan? Yeah, he came from Malaysia originally, and is now living in Singapore. He's also one of the whiz kids when it comes to suttas, and he's also very very good with these things. And he has a whole kind of series of books on this. And then once you have done all of that, then you can start with the Majjhima Nikaya. I'd recommend the Majjhima Nikaya, first of all, the mid-length sayings of the Buddha, first of all, because they are full suttas that have kind of a bit of background material, a bit about the Buddha, how he interacts with people, and then their proper delivery of a discourse at the same time. So Majjhima Nikaya, very useful, very nice to read. So if you do all that, then next time come back to me and ask what next, and I'll let you know. Okay. Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Venerable Sir.
Good afternoon.
My question relates to yesterday's sutta on the noble search.
Yeah.
I went back and I thought about it. You explained that Nibbana was translated as extinguishment, just to be closer to the audience than the Indian audience than whom Buddha was addressing. They already knew the concept of Nibbana.
Yeah.
I just wonder whether, how about the other concepts here, like because Nibbana or Nirvana over here means very different thing to Malaysian.
Is
funeral parlor. Okay. Very successful one. So completely got no idea whatsoever as to the word extinguishment. How about these other concepts in that sutta about unaging, unailing, undying, or this one I love best. Supreme Sanctuary, Yoga Kema. I mean, were all these concepts already, they already know, the audience then, for them to be like able to like catch it. Whereas over here, even now, so many thousand years later, I'm still thinking, what is unaging? You know what I'm trying to say?
Okay. Yeah. So the undying was already known, because the idea of undying was a very important part of that culture. Amata. Amarta was one of the ideas of the existing Brahmanical culture at that time. They wanted to achieve some kind of deathless state where they would exist forever after together with Brahma. The Brahmanical culture had this idea of an Atman, a self inside that was permanent. And the idea was to achieve a permanent state unified with Brahman forever, ever after. So that was a very known concept at the time. So the Buddha, when he used that word, he is actually using it in a new way, according to the Buddhist teachings. In Buddhism, it means you don't die. There is no death in the sense that the dying doesn't happen. But it doesn't have the same connotation of existing forever after as you have in the Brahmanical culture. Some of these other words, I think they are very obvious if you know Pali. You will know what they mean, because ajara means old age. So ajara means lack of old age. Yeah, if I say lack of old age, everyone knows what that means. Yeah, freedom from old age. You know what that means. So in English, when you say, what does it say? Unaging? Is that what it says? The unaging? It's a bit unclear, but if you say freedom from old age, it's more clear, probably, right? Or freedom from sickness, unailing, freedom from sickness. So I think this is also a translation problem as well, how to translate in a way that is very clear, so it actually has the same meaning in English as it has in the original Pali. But it basically means a freedom from these things. I don't think these are concepts that necessarily were existing. I think the meaning is quite obvious once you read the Pali, I would say.
You explain it, because I'm a Chinese, so the so-called concept undying to the emperor, I think Shi Wang Ti, whatever, they do not want to die. I mean, he didn't want to die. Yeah. He actually sent off people to somewhere to get some concoction or herbs or whatever so as not to die. But actually, the undying is freedom from dying. It's not that you live on forever.
Exactly. So these are two different things. One is living on forever. That's probably what the emperor wanted to do, probably live in forever. But in Buddhism, it's just the idea, because death is a problem. You don't want to have to die again. And there's many ways that can happen. One is to live forever. Another way is to stop everything. Yeah. Two different ways of kind of reaching that.
Thank you very much. I can actually imagine how people can misunderstand.
Yeah.
These ideas.
People misunderstand all the time. This is actually a big problem, right? It's a very, very big problem. Absolutely.
Thank you for teaching us.
Okay, great. Good. Thank you.